Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Yud Daled Amud Aleph by the two dots. Itmar, kinyan, ade matai chuzer. When a person engages in a kinyan, how long do they have to back out of the kinyan? In essence, this is the equivalent of buyer's remorse, which is that even when a person engages in a kinyan, the way that the Rashbam phrases it, is that kimle derabbanan. The Rabbanan knew that even though a person is engaged in such a kinyan, which usually entails gemirat hadat, a finalization of whatever has occurred or is entailed in this transaction, nevertheless, adaiti dehochi makne inish, sheiten li bo achrei kein, viyadaim efshar lo bikinyan zela soto kinyan gamur. Person only after they have that gemirat hadat, they take a moment to reflect on it, to see if they really can carry out the transaction, or carry through with the transaction. And therefore, there has got to be a window of time in which he can assess that which he has agreed to. And that window, according to the Rashbam, gives him the opportunity to add in additional conditions, or to relent on the transaction as a whole. And again, it's something akin to buyer's remorse over here. After we discuss it, we'll look back and see where the application is. Rabbi says, as long as they're still sitting, they sat down together in order to discuss the matter. As long as they're still seated, even though possibly the topic has changed, they've moved on. But as long as they're still seated for that kinyan, then the kinyan is not finalized. Once they get up, obviously, then the kinyan is finalized. Rabbi Yosef Amar, Kozman Sheuskim Beoto Inyan. Rabbi Yosef says it has nothing to do with whether they're still sitting there, whether they stood up or they didn't stand up. It all has to do with topically. If they're still discussing the matter, then the matter is still open. As soon as they stop discussing the matter, they move over to another topic, then the matter is closed. The reason this is brought here is because of the case that we saw yesterday. Amar Rabbi Yosef, Kavati Didi Mistavra. According to me, it makes a lot more sense what I'm saying. Damar Rabbi Yehuda. Because we had yesterday, the Rebbe Yehuda says, Shlosha shenichdesu lebaker techole, three people who came in to visit someone who was sick, Ratzu kotvim, Ratzu osim din. They have the ability to decide whether they're going to act as a dim and document that which they're hearing from the individual that's there. Ratzu osim din. Or on the other hand, they could become judges and therefore adjudicate the case, deliberate the case, and then make decisions regarding that matter. As the Yanim, they would not have to document it. They would not have to have Edim testify. They would be the Dayanim themselves. We discussed why it is that they are Dayanim. Yesterday, the Rashbam thinks it's because seeing is believing. And so if they're there and they are actually seeing and hearing from this individual, that's better than hearing it from someone else. So they clearly can be Dayanim. We also saw the Rashbam says this, and it was emphasized by the Ramban, that the reason is because hodat baal din kemeya edim dami, that when the baal din admits to something, it's the equivalent of 100 edim. It's as if he is giving edut before them. Therefore, they're functioning as dayanim. V'isak adatcha kol zman sheyoshvim. If you say that as long as they're seated, that the topic is open, leichosh dilma hadarbe. Let us worry about the fact that he might reverse his position. The way that the Rishbam phrases over here, hey ha, kevan diyacholach zorbo, since he has a right of retraction, vivatela din, and that would undermine whatever din or whatever deliberations are made by these dayanim, lo havi din. It is completely null and void. You can't have a din like this. According to the Rashbam, it's a core failure in the din to have a beit din deliberating or deciding about a matter that can be reversed. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot don't say that it's a fundamental flaw in the din, but rather something that we don't want to happen, which is we don't want a beit din to come to a conclusion with the parties having a residual right to change their mind about it after the fact. Because in essence, that undermines the value of a beit din and the power of the beit din, because the balei din can change the matter after the fact. So the balei HaTosafot say it's more of a technical issue, which is that we don't want batei dinim making decisions or coming to conclusions or deliberating matters that can be changed by the parties. The Rashbam sees it as a more fundamental problem, which is if you can change the matter, then you can't have a din, because you can't come to a psak because of the fact that someone has a right to change that which is there. The underlying assumption, of course, is that when they came to sit down, the vaker, the chuleh, is that that's they're seated, they're sitting there. They didn't change their position, they didn't do anything. And therefore, Rav Yosef says, like I'm saying, they could be sitting there and they change topics. Once they change topics, there's no way to retract the kinyan that was done. On the other hand, according to you, Rabbo, who says they have to stand up, who said they stood up over here? Nothing changed over here. They simply were sitting, and then they went into this din, and it's considered to be a din because they were sitting there. So there was no change in their position. Now, this goes back to, again, what we saw yesterday as to what was the scenario that we were speaking about. The Rishbam believed that the scenario is a shchiv meira, someone on their deathbed that's doing a matana b'miktzat. They are giving away a portion of their property. Since they're giving away a portion of their property, they don't have a right then to change their mind later on. And if you do a kinyan on it, it will finalize that transaction. The Balei Tosafot said yesterday, it was speaking about a case of a bari, a healthy individual who was giving away their property, and in doing so, had a kinyan to formalize it. And so to over here, it'll be the same scenario, which is that we have a kinyan here to finalize it. Question is, when does that kinyan become effective so that these dayanim can actually be dayanim? According to Rav Yosef, it happens as soon as they change topics, and therefore they are dayanim. According to Rabbi, it would only happen once they stood up. And we don't find any evidence of the fact that they stood up. They just came to visit. They were mevaker choleh. We don't see any indication of them changing positions in order to have the din be finalized, and that's when they become dayanim. They just said they were sitting there and they become dayanim by the mere fact that they are present and sitting there. And so Rabbi Yosef says, that's a proof to my position that changing topics is sufficient grounds for the ending of the kinyan. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Ashi, Amrita l'shmaitata kameid Rav Kahana. I said this in front of Rav Kahana, Ule Rav Yosef minecha. How do you know for Rav Yosef that that scenario is also easy to work out? Leichush dilma hadarbe. Why don't you worry about the fact that he might have changed his mind? Elamayit t'chal meimar. So then, how are you going to explain this according to Rav Yosef? Diasliku minyana linyana. That they changed topics. You have to explain, according to Rav Yosef, they changed topics. If they didn't change topics, you have the same problem for Rav Yosef as you have for Rabba, which is that he can retract the kinyan. And then how could they be a Beit Din? Hachanami. So you could say the same thing for Rabba. The kamu, v'hadu yativu. They stood up, and then they sat down again. So even though it's a more difficult explanation, that's why Rav Yosef assumed that this case was a proof to him and not to Rabba. Nevertheless, Rav Ashi says the same way that Rav Yosef still has to place some sort of ukimta into the case to say that they switched topics, which is not mentioned there. So too, Rabba will say that they stood up and they sat down in the case. Obviously, Rav Yosef's explanation is a little easier to understand than Rabba's explanation, but still, Rav Yosef needs that to be entered into the case, that they actually changed topics, which isn't mentioned, and so too, we'll say for Rabba, even though it's not mentioned, they stood up and they sat down, and that's how they are dayanim. Or you could suggest that Rav Yosef's hesitance to explain it in the way that would be supportive of Rabba is the fact that, according to him, once the three individuals sit down, they become a Beit Din right away, because in that sitting, they were able to complete the kinyan and finish off this transaction. On the other hand, for Rabba, they're going to have to stand up and then sit down again. So their original sitting may not be koveya them as the dayanim, because only after they've stood and then sat down is there a completion of the transaction, and only in that second sitting do they become then dayanim. But that implies maybe that they weren't dayanim in the first time that they had sat down. V'hilchata kavate de Rav Yosef. Gemara here, paskins like Rav Yosef, b'sadeh, inyan, u'mechta. In these three areas, the halacha is like Rav Yosef. So now, we have a number of things to discuss over here. First of which is, we have a principle, Rabbah Rav Yosef, halacha k'rabba. So now the Gemara is telling us here that there are exceptions to that rule. And these three exceptions are besadeh, which we saw back on Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet, where we're dealing with brothers that are splitting a property and one of them wants it in a certain location. And the other brothers can say, well, that property has super value to us, or has more value to us than the other parts of the property, and they can deny him that right to take the property, even though technically he's the bar mitzvah in that case. And there, Rav Yosef made a statement that they can make that claim, that it's worth more to us, or there's something particular about that property that makes it a higher value, and therefore it's not zenene bezilo chaser, it is ze chaser because of the way they assign value to that property. Our case over here, inyan, changing topics, the locha is like Rav Yosef, as well as a sugya further on of mechza. When a person gives away property and says, I'm giving it to so-and-so and so-and-so, how do we know what the division of property is? So Rav Yosef over there says, if you give it to two people, for instance, he gives it to his wife and his son, or he gives it to his mother and his son, that it means 50-50 based on the psukim in the Torah that show a division or an actual division of 50-50. Based on that, Rav Yosef says that that division is 50-50. Those are the three cases where the Gemara says the locha is like Rav Yosef. In the first two cases, Besadeh and Inyan, there is a machloket between Rav Yosef and Rabba. The case of Mechza, Rabba does not appear at all. And there is no machloket between Rabba and Rav Yosef over there. Nevertheless, the Gemara says, Alocha Kamoto. So Bar Tosafot say, why do you need Alocha to Rav Yosef over there if Rabba's not even arguing on him? So the Bar Tosafot answer that Abaye questions Rav Yosef's premise over there. Abaye was a Talmid of Rav Yosef. He's also a Talmid of Rabba. He questions Rav Yosef. And the Tosafot suggests that maybe we would have thought that the Locha is not like Rav Yosef over there based on the questioning of Abaye. Because remember, Rav Yosef fell ill and forgot all of his learning. And then he regained it afterwards. Maybe we would question Rav Yosef's statement there because of that fact that he had fell ill and lost all of his learning. And Abaye's question would cause us not to pass him like Rav Yosef. So that's why the Gemara says the Locha is like Rav Yosef even though there's no one arguing on him. Others suggest that Abaye, who's both the Talmid of Rabba and Rav Yosef, over there, the Gemara had a Masora that Abaye's question of Rav Yosef was deriving from Rabba. In that case, it would make it into a Machloket, Rabba and Rav Yosef as well. The bigger question, which is raised by Tosafot here and other places in Shas, is how broad is the statement of the Gemara over here? The Gemara over here says the Halacha is like Rav Yosef, implying that in other places the Halacha is not like Rav Yosef, because it would be like Rabba, and that's why the Gemara has to state the three exceptions. How broad is that principle? All three exceptions noted here are in the Gemara Baba Batra. That means that maybe all the Gemara is saying is, in any machlok between Rabba and Rav Yosef, in Baba Batra, the Halacha is like Rabba, with the exception of these three cases where it's like Rav Yosef. Or is this a broader principle, which says throughout Shas, Halacha k'Rabba neged Rav Yosef, with the exception of these three cases. They all happen to be in Baba Batra, but that doesn't limit the klal to Baba Batra. It's a general principle that Halacha is k'Rabba neged Rav Yosef. The question really comes up in the Gemara in Baba Kama, where you have a machloket Rabba and Rav Yosef, where it seems that, according to many Rishonim there, the Halacha is like Rav Yosef. And therefore, how do you deal with that given this principle? So again, you can either say that you limit the principle to Baba Batra, and therefore it's not an issue. You could believe that even with every other klal in the Gemara, there are exceptions to the rule. Here, the Gemara is only dealing with the exceptions in Baba Batra, but there are other exceptions in Shas, and that's one of them. Or, the Rabbeinu Tam over there says, Halacha is like Rabba over there, and not like Rabbi Yosef, and he disagrees with many of the Rishonim, and says the Halacha is like Rabba. This principle of Halacha k'Rabba neged Rabbi Yosef, how broadly you think that principle is applied, derives from how you read this Gemara or the limitations that you have on this Gemara. So that's one important factor. The second important factor is going back to the beginning of the sugya now. Now we know the Halacha is like Rav Yosef. Where does it have application? Is it a broad application? That is what the Rashbam, the Rabbeinu Tam, brings. And they seem to indicate that this applies to any kinyan. This is a general principle in kinyanim. And any kinyan that be effectuated would have this buyer's remorse time period in order for the person to assess the kinyan. So that's one perspective. You have people all the way on the other end of the spectrum who say that this is only relevant by kinyanim of shchiv meira. It's only relevant when you're dealing with a shchiv meira that's gifting and has a kinyan there, that this is a window of opportunity to unwind it. So those are the two extremes. The one extreme saying that it applies to all kinyanim. The other extreme saying that it only applies to a kinyan of a shchiv meira. The middle ground that is brought by the Ramban from the Rabbi Yehuda Albert Saloni that suggests the middle position that says it only applies to a kinyan sudar. It has to do with representative kinyanim. If you're doing a physical kinyan that is recognized like mishicha, misira, or hagba, that's a kinyan that has finality to it, without any buyer's remorse. The only time you have this buyer's remorse is when you use representative kinyan of kinyan sudar. There you have this ability to unwind the kinyan or to think about it after the fact. It's a window of opportunity when you do a kinyan sudar. Maybe because it is a representative kinyan, it has less gemirat adat associated with it, and therefore we give you this little extra window of time in order to have the gemirat adat. So that's the spectrum of kinyanim that this might apply to. Again, the possibility that it's limited to just the kinyan shemira, possibility that applies to all kinyanim, and a middle ground, which is it applies only to a kinyan sudar. So now the Gemara continues with something that we already noted when we read the Mishnah, and we said the Gemara will get to this later on, which is the section of the Mishnah that have a mirror effect of each other, which is in the middle cases of the Mishnah where it says, Ha'ishat imo, a son towards his mother, Va'ishat ishto, and a husband towards his wife, Ubnei achayot, or really the girsa of the Rashbam is Ubnei achot, Nochlim velo manchilim. They inherit, but they do not bequeath inheritance. And then you have the next section of the Mishnah, the third set of cases in the Mishnah, Ha'ishad bina, a mother towards her child, Ha'ishad bala, a woman towards her husband, Ve'acheyaim, and the uncles through the mother's brother. And again, that's how the Rashbam proved that the case before should have been bnei achot, manchilim velo nochlim. They bequeath inheritance, they do not inherit. That case is exactly the opposite of the previous case. It seems totally extraneous. All they're doing is repeating all the cases from the reverse perspective. Why do you need that? And that is the nature of the Gemara's question over here. Ha tu lamali. What do I need this additional section of the Mishnah? Atanale Reisha. It's already written in the previous cases of the Mishnah. We already have in the previous cases the Ishet Imo. The son inherits his mother. Va'ishet Ishto. And the husband towards his wife. Of course, if the section before lists three people that are nochel velo manchil, that inherit without granting or bequeathing inheritance, then the reverse of those relationships bequeath inheritance and do not inherit. So why repeat it? It's completely repetitive and unnecessary. So where it says, so it's because of, according to the Bach, it says Amar Rav Sheshet over here, Hakamashmalan di'isha et bina dumya di'isha et bala, that a woman vis-a-vis her son has the same relationship or nature as a woman with her husband. So we're going to explain this. There are different views in the Rishonim as to how exactly this works. Ma'ishad bala, just like a woman vis-a-vis her husband, ain't a bal yoresh et ishto bekever, the husband does not inherit his wife when she has already predeceased those that are going to bequeath inheritance to her. Afishad bina, so too a woman vis-a-vis her son, ain't a ben yoresh et imo bekever, the son does not inherit his mother when he's already predeceased his mother, v'anchila achim min av, to grant that Yerusha to his brothers through the father. So now this, according to the way that the Rashbam reads it, it is similar to the case that we just saw in yesterday's daf, which is that the Baal is not inheriting b'ra'oi kemuchzak. The Baal only inherits his wife's inheritance, that which she has in possession at the time of her death. Items that would come into her possession after her death, the husband will not inherit. The example we gave yesterday was, if the woman predeceases her parents, she's the sole inheritor of her parents, and she predeceases her parents. At that point, when she passes away, the way that Yerusha normally works would be that the Yerusha would pass from the parents to this woman, and then from the woman to the closest inheritor. Closest inheritor is her husband right now. So even though she's already passed away, it would move to her and then to her husband. What the Gemara told us yesterday is that's not the case, because it's ra'oi and not muhzak. Only if she already had inherited her parents would the husband get it. But if she has yet to inherit her parents, she predeceased them, and now the property falls to her after her death, the husband will not be the inheritor, but rather will go to her son, who is the next of kin. If she has no children, then it'll move to the closest relatives of the parents. So that's the din that we learned yesterday with regards to the fact that a baal, a husband, does not inherit his wife when she's in the kever. What the Gemara is saying according to Rashbam is, we have a similar din by a child, which is the fact that if a child passes away, predeceases his mother, then the property will not pass to that child in order to give it to his brothers through the father. The primary inheritors of this individual, if he has no children, will be his brothers. His brothers are related to him through the father, because for Yerusha, that's the only thing that matters. So if he inherits his mother, and then he passed away, and he has no offspring, then the next in line, or next of kin, would be his brothers, assuming there's no father there, assuming that these are half-brothers, so therefore they don't share a common mother, only a common father, they would be the inheritors of that property. What the Mishnah is telling us is if the son already predeceased his mother, then we don't view it as if when she passes away, passes the property to her son, and then the brothers inherit that son after he's already passed away. So that's the common denominator between these. If that son had a son, then it would pass to that son or that child, because that's a direct descendant of that individual. They step into the shoes of that individual. And therefore, if that child had another child, had a son or a daughter, they would inherit, even after he's passed away, from the mother directly down to those descendants of his, because they have a relationship to the mother. They are the grandchildren of that mother. The brothers, through the father, have no relationship, blood relationship, to the mother is passing it to her son. That's the way the Rashbam explains the sugya over here, which is that, similar to what we saw yesterday, that a husband did not inherit his wife once she has passed away, so too, the mother is passing Yerusha to a son. If the son has already passed away, then brothers will not inherit from him. That's the Rashbam's explanation. The question you have to ask, of course, is, why is it, or how do you know that that's the case? The Gemara brings no proof to that. It simply says that the Mishnah tells you that information. So the Rashbam over here tells us that it is logical. The Svarahu, the Kevin de Maid Pnah, Mikamedi Dida, since her son predeceased her, Pakalo Kocho Birushatimo, he's lost all rights to the Yerusha of his mother, and then he's erased from the picture. There's no reason to pass it to the father's family, because the father's children have no relationship to this mother, because they were through a different mother. And that's why the Mishnah is coming to teach us this din. And the remainder of the items are just brought agav. They're just brought down as incidental issues, but the main issue is these two to be makish, the husband and the wife, and the mother and the son. Now, the problem with the Rashbam, which is pointed out by the Balei Tosafot, is that the cases are not equal. Cases are not the same. In one case, you're saying that the husband who's still alive does not inherit his wife when she has passed away. On the other hand, with regards to the son over here, you're saying that the son no longer inherits his mother who is still alive. The son versus the husband are not of a comparable nature. In this case, the husband's still alive, and he doesn't inherit his wife who's deceased. The son, who you're comparing to this husband, has passed away. And his brothers do not inherit him if his mother's still alive, and she would have passed Yerusha to him. So the two cases are totally different. One case, you're talking about a husband who's still alive, and the person who passed away was the wife. Here, you're talking about a son who's passed away, and you're comparing the son who passed away to a husband who's still alive. So the cases are not of equivalent nature. There are those that want to frame it on behalf of the Rashbam in the following manner. It has to do with the brothers of this individual. And you could just look at it from that perspective, which is similar to the husband who does not inherit his wife if she predeceased those that are bequeathing her, so too the brothers through the father will not inherit their brother if he predeceased the bequeather, who is the mother in this case. So you can make it somewhat similar, but those are not the cases that are mentioned in the Mishnah. The Mishnah makes the case of a son vis-a-vis his mother, and a husband vis-a-vis his wife. Therefore, the Balei Tosafot believe that the case here is a case where the husband has passed away. And in a case where the husband has passed away, he does not inherit his wife. So normally, again, Yerusha would pass to individuals even if they're in the Kever. What we're saying here is, just like a husband who passes away does not inherit his wife, so too a child who passed away will not inherit his mother. In that case, you're talking with exactly equivalent cases, because now in both cases, you're talking about the person who has passed away does not inherit. The husband does not inherit his wife once he's passed away. The son does not inherit his mother when he has passed away. The problem for the Balei Tosafot now is, how do you know that the husband does not inherit his wife once he is deceased? In the previous case, according to the Rashbam, we learned that from Psukim in Divrei Yamim. And in Yoshua, the fact that a husband does not inherit his wife when she predeceases her bequeathers. That's what we learned in yesterday's daf. So we know that information. Now the Mishnah passes that along to explain the case of Ben as well. But we have a source for one of them. In the way that the Tosfot is explaining it, we don't have a source for either of them. We don't have a source for the fact that a husband who passes away does not inherit his wife after he has passed away. And number two is we don't have a source for the fact that a child does not inherit his mother when he has passed away. So how do you know one over the other? We're saying, oh, we learned son from husband. How do you know the case by the husband is true? So the Tosafot over here brings down different options as to why it would be the case. The first of which is suggested by the Rivam, which is that there's a big difference between kurva, which is blood relationship, and kurva, which is generated through marriage or artificial in nature. And that is that blood relationships survive death. Because blood relationship has nothing to do with being alive or being dead, and it simply has to do with the fact that the relationship is of a blood lineage. On the other hand, when you deal with marriage or she'er, which is the fact that they are guf echad, the fact that they are single entity, is generated by the marriage. They have no blood relationship. It's all generated through the kiddushin. If the kiddushin is gone, so has the relationship dissolved. And that's what the Rivam suggests. I said something along those lines to explain what we said yesterday, that when the husband passes away, by definition, there's no longer inheritance coming to him because he's no longer related to his wife. Once he passes away, there's nothing residual that leaves them related in any way because they don't have any blood connection. They only have kiddushin. When he passes away, the kiddushin is gone, and that means that the kurva is gone, and that's why the husband will not inherit his wife once he has passed away. So that's why it's obvious to the Gemara here that the husband would not inherit. And therefore, now we extend that to the son through the Hekesh of the Mishnah, that the son, even though he's a blood relationship to his mother, he will not inherit his mother when he is already passed away. And again, that the Rashbam explained to us the svara, the logic behind that, why we would say such a thing. That is the suggestion of the Rivam. The Ri says that he doesn't think that's necessarily true, and makes a alternate suggestion, which is the fact that with something called Mishmush, which is something that we'll get to coming up, is the ability of someone who's already passed away to inherit and pass it to their other inheritors, or to bequeath inheritance once they have passed away. That mishmush, we have a source for that, but that source only relates to a child or to blood relationships. It is not something that we learn by a baal v'isha. So it's not necessarily connected to she'er, it's that we don't have a source for the fact that a husband would have mishmush, or the ability to pass something once he's already passed away. Since he doesn't have that, he can't bequeath the inheritance to anyone else, so it's not going to come to him because he doesn't bequeath it. On the other hand, by blood relationships, we do have such a concept of mishmush, which we'll find a source for upcoming in the Gemara, and that's the difference between a husband and a child, and that's why it's obvious that the husband does not inherit to bequeath when he's passed away already, because we don't have any source for that. We don't have any concept of mishmush by the husband. And then the Rosh Mishnah, on the other hand, in defense of the Rashbam's explanation, as well as to explain this issue, says he doesn't think the Ri is right. He does favor the Rivam, but he says that there is a difference. Certain parts of She'er, certain parts of the relationship of husband and wife dissolve when it comes to the death of the spouse. Certain of them remain intact. So in Okanami, She'er does survive death, but it does not survive with regards to Yerusha. And how do you know that? Because we saw yesterday that the wife does not bequeath to her husband after she has passed away. So from that, you could extrapolate and say that, similarly, in a reverse situation, the husband will not inherit his wife when he's in the kever. Because what we proved yesterday is that once the death happens, the line of inheritance is broken, even though they might still have classification of she'er. And that's what we have from yesterday, the proof from yesterday, and if you apply that to what we're saying today, the same would be true. That she'er, as far as Yerusha is concerned, is broken by that fact that one of the parties or spouses has passed away. And therefore, the source for the fact that a husband does not inherit his wife after he has passed away derives from the fact that a husband does not inherit his wife once she has passed away. Because they derive from the same reason, which is that there's no Yerusha in She'er once one of the spouses has passed away. And that's what the Rosh Mishnah says is the reasoning behind the Rashbam. And in that way, he would also end up solving the problem of why the Rashbam didn't mention the case of a husband passing away, but rather the wife passing away, because He thinks the source for when the husband passes away that he does inherit is from the fact that when the wife passes away, the husband does not inherit.
The Rabbeinu Gershom almost has both shitot over here, and he brings down that the case is a situation in which
Af isha bana in a bin yureshet imo bekever shim nafla la yirusha lachar mitata. If she comes into possession of property after she's passed away, the son will not inherit her in order to pass it on to his brothers. He can inherit it only as long as he's alive. And then afterwards to the krovim av. So the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom is learning it is that both the mother and the son have passed away. And in that instance, the brothers of this son, who have share a common father, will not inherit through two people who are already in the kever. Their brother who's in the kever, whose mother's in the kever, coming from some bequeather that would have given it to the mother, down to the son, to them. And that the Rabbeinu Gershom says it doesn't move through those two people in the kever, but in that way, the Rabbeinu Gershom creates a case that is similar both to that of the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot, because both the mother and the son have passed away in this instance. All right, so now the Gemara continues. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yehuda bi Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yochanan says, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda bi Rabbi Shimon, the Rishbam over here notes the difference between saying Amar Rabbi Yochanan Amar Rabbi Yehuda bi Rabbi Shimon versus what we have in our Gemara, which says Mishum, has to do with whether the individual was his Rabbo Amuhak, whether he was his primary Rebbe. If it's his primary Rebbe, then it will say Amar, Amar. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon. If it is just someone that he quotes on occasion, but it's not his Rebbe Amuvak, then it will say Mishum. It will say that Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum, in the name of or from this individual, because it was unusual for him to quote it, it isn't a direct line of Rabbo Amuvak. The example that Rishbam brings is that Rabbi Yochanan, who was the Talmid Muvak of Rabbi Yanai, would say, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yanai. On the other hand, he would not say, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, because it wasn't his Rabbo Amuvak, and therefore he uses the word Mishum. So that's it, the Rishbam gives you a principle that you can apply through Shas. Nevertheless, this is what he says over. Dvar Torah, Ha'av Yoreshit Beno. Mina Torah, a father inherits his son, that we already saw before, because of either the limud of she'ero, or because of avartem nachlato, that we learned earlier, that the father is a primary inheritor of a child. If the person has no children, then it goes to the father. If there's no father, then it goes to the brothers. And that was the hierarchy of inheritors that the individual has. But here the chiddush of Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon is, that av yoreshet beno, v'isha yoreshet et bina. And a mother inherits her son. So not only does a father inherit his son, so too a mother inherits her son. Now it's clear here, if the father's alive, that the father takes precedence over the mother, and he would give it to the father and not to the mother. The question is, when the father has already passed away, this son passes away without any children, is the mother entitled to the inheritance? According to Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, the answer is yes. It's obvious that that does not agree with our Mishnah, because our Mishnah says that a son inherits his mother, but the mother does not inherit the son. So that will be what we deal with in tomorrow's Gemara. But at least for right now, we have Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon telling us that a mother has the same din as a father with regards to this. Shenemar matot. Because the Pasuk says matot in plural. V'chol bat yoresh nachalami matot b'nei Yisrael. From different matot. So here we have a situation in which there is a mother and a father that are from different Shvatim, and then they have a child that obviously follows in the Shevet of the father, and then if you have a daughter that then would get married, then you would have a problem because you might have a shifting of the Nachla if her husband or if her child then inherits her, and that's where the requirement of the Torah, at least for that generation, was that she has to marry someone from her Shevet in order that the Nachla does not move. So that matot, mekish mata'im, the mata'av. That marriage involved a man and a woman who came from different shvatim. And you see that the matot compares or joins the father and the mother to say that the mother has same rights as the father. Ma mata'av, av yoreshet beno. Just like by the shevet of the father inherits the son. Afmataim isha yereshet et bina. So too, by the shevet of the mother inherits the son. And then, that's what's going to bring us to tomorrow's Gemara, which is Eitvei Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yochanan questioned this position, Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon, Aishad Bina, Baishad Bala, Vachayim, Manchilim Velo Nochlim. Our Mishnah is explicit that that's not the case. Therefore, how is it possible that Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon says something against our Mishnah? He answers, and we'll again delve into this more tomorrow, Amarlein Mishnatenu Eni Yodea Mishana. I don't know who the author of our Mishnah is, but obviously what he's saying is that I don't hold with the Mishnah. Whoever the author of the Mishnah is wrong, and I have a drasha that indicates otherwise, that a son does pass inheritance to his mother. Just like he inherits from his mother, he passes inheritance back to his mother. The Balei HaTosafot are very bothered by this, because then you run into a significant problem. The Torah tells you, Lo tisov nachalami mateh lamateh. You can't have nachla moving from shevet to shevet, and therefore they prescribe that the mother marry someone from the in her shevet. Well, did we learn from those psukim two things? One was sibata ba'al, and one was sibata ben. In a case where you have a husband from a different shevet, you have a problem because the husband inherits the wife, and you might have the same problem where you have a son that is born of that mixed shevet wedlock, because of the fact that the son follows the shevet of his father. If he's going to inherit his mother, there will also be a transference. So the mother should marry someone from within her shevet to solve that problem. So that's what the Torah prescribes in order to deal with the problem. If what Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon says is correct, we have a third possibility of Yerusha moving from shevet to shevet, which is if the mother inherits the son, then it's a possibility then the son would be from one shevet, and he'd be giving Yerusha to his mother, who's from a different shevet. For instance, if the father's from Reuven, the mother's from Shimon, the child that's born from them is shevet Reuven. If the father passed away, and the son has inheritance, he has no children, and he passes away, according to Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, the possessions of the son now will go back to the mother, who's from shevet Shimon. So now you have a possibility that Yerusha will move from Reuven to Shimon, because of the way the Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon sets it up. And nowhere do we find in the Torah a requirement that the husband take a wife from the same shevet. The requirement is only on the wife to take a husband from the same shevet to protect against moving of Nachla. We don't find anything in reverse. And therefore the Balei HaTosafot are very bothered by this structure. They come up with this solution, which is very interesting, and they say, B'nir l'rbeinu tam u'l'ri d'b'giyoret kamar. We're talking about a giyoret, someone who's converted, dioreshet et bina, and inherits her son, v'nafka mina shloyu nichasav hefker, in order that his possessions would not be hefker. It's not a case where we're talking about shvatim, because in that case, even Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon would agree that the mother does not inherit, because it would be impossible to have the mother inherit and not have the Torah address that and say that the husband must marry a woman from his own shevet. Because that would be the same problem. The fact that the Torah doesn't demand that shows you that the Torah is not worried about that. The Torah is not worried about it. It means that a son does not inherit the mother. Where is that one scenario or that sole scenario where the son inherits his mother? We're speaking about a giyoret. We're speaking about conversions where the property would go to hefker based on the fact that a ger who has no relatives, property is hefker. So we say in that situation it doesn't go to hefker, it goes back to the mother. But over there, you're not talking about havarat nachala, mishevet the shevet, and that's how the Balei HaTosafot avoid that problem of what does Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon do with the sukim in the Torah, which seem to indicate against what he's saying, or do not even address what he's saying. They say that's right, because the case that we have here is not a case that is relevant to the cases of the Torah, because we're dealing with a giyoret. All right, we're going to stop here by the bottom of Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Bet.